Lael Atkinson is a certified professional recovery coach who works at the intersection of drinking and dieting. During their experience of parting ways with alcohol and then tackling a lifetime of dieting, disordered eating, and body shame, they found limited resources that address this frequent overlap of shrinking and drinking. This led Lael to create a course and specialize in supporting clients who want to examine their relationship with alcohol and divest from diet culture. We are thrilled to welcome Lael to Sober Sex.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, gut and spiritual growth. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, we're never ever bored. Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, and mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, gut and spiritual growth. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more.
So, dear listeners, we just had a beautiful conversation for about 5 minutes, and then my internet went out and I had to change locations. Lael was very patient with me. So we'll start from the top. How are you?
You know, it's funny. That actually helped me be less nervous. So now I'm just excited.
Oh, beautiful. I love how you were able to pivot into a space of optimism. And we discussed previously that you are in the Pacific Northwest in the beautiful state of Washington. Mm-hmm. And how is it there right now? How are you feeling about it?
It's actually super rainy, but that I don't know. I'm all cozy indoors, so I kind of love it.
Awesome. Yes. Yeah. As I just like dashed through the rain holding a microphone with the dog. I'm like, I'm not a huge fan of the rain as I was like prior to our break. Anyway, and you had mentioned that your pronouns are they, them.
Yes.
And again, I'm going to ask about your experience of gender today.
Yeah, it is somewhere between all genders and no gender. So take that as you will.
Is that like, if you don't mind, I'm going to nudge a little bit. Like, how did you kind of land at that space? Was that a journey or was that the kind of natural arrival point that you're like, oh, this is
yeah. Me. I mean, as far as just identifying as they, them, and I went through, and I'm not saying, this is just my experience. I'm not saying like, anyway, I'm not trying to speak for anybody else, but I did use they, she for a while. And then, at some point it just, and that really fit for a while. And then at some point I was like, it was more about making other people comfortable, the like mm-hmm. leaving the she in there. And I was like, you know, I'm ready to go all in. And it felt right for me. I just feel like Lael. So that's sort of, yeah. And when it comes to, I mean, it's such a murky thing, you know? And I don't know how, you know, if we were born into a world where nobody even discussed it, like, yeah, that would be an interesting experiment as well. But and that's not to say it doesn't matter, because it definitely does or can. But so I don't know what the difference is between being everything and being nothing. I mean, that's why I'm like, maybe somewhere in the middle of those.
Yeah. Or kind of oscillating, maybe. That's right. Cool though. Cause it's like when you talk about, the idea of if we were born into a place where, or a world where it didn't matter, I do think that that's when we start to see that you're like, oh, this is a social construct because mm-hmm. of the way in which it's politicized. And like, now we're seeing like, where you're born and when you're born and who you're raised with and what your community is like are big factors in determining how people identify, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so it's kind of like, this is evidence, is it not?
Right. Yep. And I know there are certain like societal things, at least in Western society, that just, for better or worse, are associated with being kind of, I don't know, just like that just never appeal. I was always like, yeah, not my thing. So, mm-hmm. Yeah,
totally. And like, what a beautiful thing to be able to be like, actually, I do, like, I know who I am enough to be able to kind of like, discern what is my thing and what is not my thing, you know?
For sure. Yep.
And I think that that's even something that like, I know I identify as she, her, and like as a cis person, I think that's also really important too.
Of course.
To be able to be like, oh, I can actually choose kind of what my path through this looks like.
Yep.
That I think for a long time in kind of heteronormative culture, that was not necessarily like a thing.
Right. It's getting better. There's still, yeah, still a long way to go. But yes.
And, you know, you, so in our brief previous conversation, you'd mentioned that your dad was in public health. Especially around it, like around family planning specifically. So that in our anchor question of what were your first experiences or your first messages around sex and sexuality, that you had kind of a unique, like starting place of information.
Right. And did you want to give a shout out to Jesse's podcast?
I did want to give a shout out to Jesse's podcast. Thank you so much. So I'm going to read from my copy that I think is actually quite good. You're welcome, everybody. I reached out because I heard you as a guest on Friend of Show, Jesse Nealon's podcast. And for anyone interested, it's an excellent podcast. It's called It's Not About Your Body. And I wanted to talk to you on sober sex because obviously these things, drinking and diet culture, intersect with a lot of stuff we talk about here. And not to mention, like, I think both of our experiences kind of intersect with that. And I feel like starting way back at the beginning of the story would make more sense in this instance. Hence, what were the first messages you received around sex and sexuality?
Yep. So yes, my dad worked in, it was a little odd of an upbringing in that regard because my dad worked in public health with a focus on family planning. So even as a preteen, I remember books around the house on contraceptive technology. And that may be why when I was, I think, 12, I asked my parents, I told them I wanted to get my tubes tied, even though at that point I hadn't even kissed anyone. So they, you know, wisely said, let's maybe wait on that for a minute. So, let's see. Although to this day, I've never wanted kids of my own. So I think I actually was.
I mean, you actually, yes. Premonition. You're like, no, thank you.
Yep.
No, that's
As far as what they directly taught me, it was mainly, I don't remember any conversations with them. It was mainly through books, which to be fair, that might've also been my aversion about the thought of talking to my parents about sex. Maybe it was, you know, a little bit on both sides, but, and also, well, I know that, you know, I do think they were very open-minded and progressive. They were also kind of normal for that time. As far as the messages that I remember receiving were all very heteronormative, all very, you know, gender binary. So, you know, again, I think we've made some strides there. So that is good. The only other thing, let's see, when I was in eighth grade, I did have two separate suicide attempts and I can't remember exactly what I was thinking. And I've tried so many ways, including hypnosis and just, I don't know, so many things. Cause it really having that just kind of blank spot, in my memory is, I just, yeah, I wish I could remember, but I'm pretty sure that it had to do with my, struggling with my sexual identity. Mm-hmm. It was also at the same time that I just had my first sexual experience and it was with a girl. So putting those pieces together is, yeah, my best guess is what was going on.
Well, and unfortunately that's exactly where we got cut off. So I was saying, you know, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that and also happy that we get to sit here and have this conversation today.
Like, yeah, thank you. Me too.
Yeah. And I'm curious as to kind of how it unfolded from there. Like, not only with, you know, like an incentive to live, which seems important, vital, but also kind of around like the information you were getting around, you know, sex and gender, and also like how drinking entered the picture.
Mm-hmm. So until I came out, which was much later in life, I pretty much did repress my attraction to women unless I was drunk. So all my relationships were with men. And while a lot of those were really good relationships, looking back, I can also see the times in my life that I was with people that I would not have been with if I hadn't been drinking. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Totally. And how did drinking start? Like, what was that? I mean, it sounds like it was a kind of a important aid. Like, I think for so many of us, like, it's helpful until it's not. You know,
right.
Like it serves a very important function in our lives around survival.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yep. So I was a bit late to the party. I didn't start drinking until my sophomore year of college. And I'd gone away to this little hippie boarding school. And it was just really hard to get, we were on campus, so it was really hard to get booze. So I think that was part of it. And then when I went to college, it was a small school, but relatively, but compared to my high school, which was less than 100 people, it just seemed humongous to me. So I cowered in my room all of freshman year. Mm. And so wasn't drinking then either because I didn't go anywhere. But I had a very vivacious and outgoing roommate, and she finally dragged me out, which I'm very grateful for. And that's also when, you know, I started drinking and smoking and, you know, having all the fun.
Important.
And it kind of just, you know, gradually ramped up over time until by my, you know, mid to late 20s, I was averaging a bottle of wine a night. And then with, you know, on the weekends, definitely often drinking harder stuff and drinking even more than that. So, yep.
Totally. When did you kind of, how and when did either you decide it was a problem, or how and when did you decide to stop?
Yeah. I think, I don't know. I think subconsciously I was, and even a bit consciously, for a long time, I was at least monitoring myself to the point where I would, take a break once a year for a little bit. And I was also like, one of the ways that my disordered eating manifested was orthorexia. So that also really helped with that, you know,
yeah, as far as that's like, you're the first person I think that I've heard mention orthorexia. And I think that that's when I got sober, that definitely was like a big part of my story.
Yeah.
And for those who are listening, who might not be aware, like, can you describe orthorexia?
Yeah. I've seen different descriptions, but the one that feels most true to me is I've seen it described as an obsession with an unhealthy obsession with healthy or clean eating. And I would add on top of that, which I've also seen some definitions include this, it can also be the lifestyle, just everything. So it can, you know, encompass exercise. It can encompass just habits. It can kind of go in every direction of your life, you know, it can be just the stress around it and the obsession and, you know, which felt like I was doing the right thing at the time. You know, yeah. I mean, I would joke like, I eat well and I smoke and drink, but I eat well and exercise, and it's all about balance. I'm sorry, I still think that's kind of funny.
I mean, it is pretty funny. You're like, it is all about it is. Yeah. I think that there's one of the more challenging parts about that specific method of disordered eating, or not even method, but kind of like attachment.
Yeah.
With food and body stuff, it's like, it can be so socially praised. Like if you think, anorexia, exercise, bulimia, wait till you hear about orthorexia. Everyone thinks they're amazing.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I felt like so righteous, self-righteous and so like pure. And I don't know. And especially people praised and asked for advice and stuff. And I'm just walking around like, oh, okay, sure. Like,
totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. And like, I think that is one of the more challenging ones to kind of divest from, just because it's like, I mean, it's like California. Right. It's so socially praised. And yeah. I mean, and also I think, especially if you are like, I think a lot about kind of purity culture and like this idea of like, if you just like kind of make your body as clean as possible, like you will be somehow saved. And I think that that's in such a interesting parallel with, you know, addiction or alcoholism, that there's this kind of like split.
Yeah. See, it is all about balance. Sorry.
You're like, I mean, how'd that work out?
Oh, so well.
So happy and free. Yeah. Oh my God. Fucking nightmare. and so like, what kind of was the incentive? I guess we'll first talk about alcohol and then we'll talk about body stuff, but like how and when and why did you actually stop after kind of numerous, like, I'm sure white knuckling attempts at like dry January.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sober October.
Yeah. I didn't, I mean, I could always do it. I did not love it, you know, and was just kind of waiting till it was over. So I could, you know, like, okay, I've proven myself, whatever the hell that means. But, let's see. So you asked how and why I decided to stop. So, at that point I had come out as queer and my marriage to a man was ending. He'd moved out of the house that we owned together and, we'd actually sold it and I was running it back, which was a little odd. But it was good for me because at that point so much was changing in life and I needed things to just like slow the hell down for a minute. So it was winter in the Pacific Northwest. I was all on my own. I was really struggling mentally and emotionally. I'd also taken a leave of absence from my job. And then January came around, and as usual, I took the month off from drinking. And then February started, and I started drinking again, and it ramped up so quickly that I got scared. And so I started thinking about stopping just for like until I was out of that really dark mental space. I was never planning to quit for good. But I found a program called HIP Sobriety. It doesn't exist anymore. It kind of went through some morphed into other things. And
was it kind of like an online thing, or like how was that? What was the modality?
Yeah, it was online. So there were, sort of a school. And so there is a program like we all had, and there, I don't know how many were in my, it was called a cohort. I want to say like 20 to 30. I mean, so fairly small, but, and the community was, you know, one of the biggest aspects of it for me, especially at that point in my life. So, there was like notebooks that we went through every week, you know, and then, we had Zoom calls, and then there was an online forum, I think it was, you know, via Facebook at that point, but, they eventually moved off that. So, their approach just really worked for me. And the most important thing at that point for me was realizing that my drinking was just a symptom, mm-hmm. and that, not drinking was about so much more. It was about looking at what needed to be healed and recalibrated in my life. And that's when I started to realize that it might be something I wanted to keep doing instead of just taking a break. Yeah.
Do you remember what it felt like when that kind of idea started to like become a little bit more present?
Yeah, it was a mix of just like, I mean, a bit of horror, but then also like amazement and just like an impossibility, but also maybe possible. And the whole concept of forever, I mean, even now that's a little daunting, like not knowing what the hell the future is going to bring. So I sort of held that very lightly, but held it for the first time, you know, and yeah.
Yeah. I like the way you described that. Yeah. I think it's really interesting to kind of see what that surrender looks like for different people, just because I think it can be such a kind of unique experience, but there's also this kind of universal, kind of mixture, like you say, between like horror and relief. Cause like on one hand you realize like, oh, fuck, like my whole life kind of has to change to accommodate. And on the other hand, there's like, but I don't have to do all of the other shit I was doing that I hated doing in order to work with my disease, you know? Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. I mean, I remember I went to treatment when I was, 20 through via intervention. So it's not exactly voluntary. And I remember like, I had a boyfriend who came to visit me. And he was definitely a using buddy. And this was after he like took too much acid, called my mom, said he was Jesus, threw my computer in the river. like it was like a nightmare. Shout out Justin. And he was like, I remember trying to explain to him that like no more anything ever.
Yeah.
He was just like, not even shrooms, like not even next year. Like trying to like explain instances. I was like, no, nothing ever. And I forget, I think it probably was like within the first kind of 3 weeks that kind of clicked into place, that was like, this is a new life.
Mm. Yeah.
And the relief that came with that of just like not, cause I just know the obsession, you know, that, and the uncontrollable nature of like what would happen every time I picked up. So
yeah,
like, yeah, I like also how you really hold it like one day at a time still, because it was such a, like a it feels such a delicate thing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And things like, you know, day counting and whatnot, everybody has to figure out what works for them. And I'm all for like, if it works for you, that's great. And for some people, it's kind of too much pressure and it almost works the opposite of how it's supposed to. So
sure.
I think we all get to just experiment, you know, and like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm definitely a product of like 12 step, but I do think that there is that element of like one of the issues with day counting. And I'm like, I love stacking. Yeah. Like I'm on like a Duolingo streak of like, 1100 days or something. I'm like, look at this shit. So it definitely works for me. But I do think that there's that danger of like kind of if you lose time, you know, if there's a slip or a relapse, then like, if you lose your days, there's kind of a catastrophe that you must create.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because like, you're like, well, back to zero, might as well, you know,
it can go to this kind of perfectionism that doesn't serve everybody. Yeah,
for sure. For sure. Yeah. And so I'm curious, like, you know, what happened with your relationship with your body when you got sober?
Yeah.
How did that shift?
So it didn't happen right away, but it was only after I'd quit drinking that I was really ready to address my disordered eating. I just don't think it would have happened otherwise. So it's been a long, slow process, and there are still things that I work through even now, which is, you know, not surprising given that we're surrounded by diet culture and that, you know, I was steeped in it for so long.
Sure.
But I also learned to process my feelings both in my body and about my body without drinking at them. So big, big difference in a lot of areas of life. Yeah.
Can you kind of like talk about these processes? Cause I'm curious, like, I think I know what you're talking about and I've never heard it put that way. Mm-hmm. Like I know about, like, it took me a really long time within sobriety to like feel feelings in my body, like to actually have like emotional sensations, like have a somatic experience.
Right.
But then about the body, I think a lot of people might, like, one thing Jesse talks about a lot is like having a bad body image day, not needing to like ruin your life.
Right. Yeah.
This is a novel concept, I'm sure, for many of us.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to like, how did you process your feelings about your body? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah. And it differs on the day. And I actually took some of Jesse's courses about, you know, I mean, they also, had a course on, I think, what was it called? Making Friends with Your Feelings. So, mm-hmm. that was great. And then, I wanted to mention to you that, cause there was another of your podcasts that you, talked about, emotions, and this book, if you haven't read it, is really good. It's called The Language of Emotions.
Fantastic.
It talks about each one having a purpose. So,
excellent.
It's really good. But, you know, depending on the day, I just being aware of it, and somewhere along the line, I've taken a lot of different courses from different people, but I remember learning just how to get in the practice of, if I start, you know, going into body image stuff, stepping back and looking at what else is going on in life, because mm-hmm. it's so often just, that's the go-to, you know,
for sure.
And it's really not about that. It's about, you know, other stuff going on.
It's actually not about your body. Shocking.
Yeah. Yeah. So just the awareness helps, and knowing, you know, that especially based on past experience, it will pass. I also learned the, not trick, but just the, practice of, cause sometimes it can be a little too overwhelming. We can get stuck trying to be like, what exactly is this feeling that I'm feeling? Is it a smidge of ennui with a dash of, I mean, just.
Yeah. Like, it can get intellectual in the effort to kind of like fine point.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep. So, what was I going to say? So naming the actual physical sensation, you know, like my heart is pounding, or my head is throbbing, or my hands are tingling, just actually naming the literal physical sensation of how the emotion is manifesting is also really helpful.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
I think those are really useful tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did you feel like in a similar way to, like, it didn't sound like you had like necessarily a white light experience with stopping drinking, that like, that there wasn't the kind of grand flash of like, I never need to do this again, but more rather kind of a delicate unfolding of like, maybe this could be a different life. Does that sound accurate?
Are you talking about the drinking or the body image stuff?
For the drinking.
Okay.
But then I'm curious if there was a similar thing that happened with the body image stuff. Cause I know my journey with that was so much, like so much slower.
Yeah. Yeah. It's still a work in progress. It is. It's so, I don't know, in a way it's just a lot bigger, and it's so mm-hmm. much, messier in a sense, you know?
Yeah.
And,
cause you have to eat and you have to move to some extent.
Like, right. Right. Yep. Yep.
I guess you have to have a body is really the issue.
Yeah. You can't just be like, okay, I'm just not going to do that anymore.
We're done here.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you? Is same experience?
You know, I think like it was the kind of first and last, and it's kind of where I go when I'm struggling and I feel like the need to control something. That's just kind of where the obsession will like click in. Yeah. But I do feel like there was a couple moments in the last, like just kind of over the course of my recovery, like it certainly wasn't able to kind of happen while I was still using. Cause like for me, cocaine was my drug of choice. And that was definitely kind of part of it, you know, like stopping drinking cause there were too many calories and doing more cocaine, which is like a psychotic move. But I remember there was a moment like when I was still in Los Angeles and kind of very deep in my that pit, like my eating disorder, and was just like, oh my God, it will never get, like, it will never be enough. Like I knew for the first time that it would never be enough. Like it didn't matter what I did or how I trained or what I didn't eat or ate, it would never be enough. And I was just like, I think that was a very helpful revelation because like, it didn't necessarily stop the behaviors, but it was like,
yeah,
there was some clarity, I guess.
Yeah.
And then on the kind of brighter, more liberating side, there was like a moment in therapy that I do gestalt therapy, which is like a lot of experiments about like they do what's called one of the more kind of notable parts of that process is called chair work, where you kind of put different parts of yourself into different chairs and then keep switching positions. So you're kind of having a dialogue with different parts. Mm-hmm. And like my mind and my body were in two different chairs. And wow. For the first time, my body was able to be like, I will never be enough. Like, it doesn't matter how hard I work to protect you and to serve you and to do whatever you ask, you will always hate me. Oh. Like, and that was so hard to hear, you know?
Wow.
And it made me have a different relationship with wanting to be an ally to my body. And I made a promise to never abuse it like I had been abusing it, you know? And that's been like a journey, but
yeah.
But it feels like the steps I take now are around working towards having a joyful relationship with my body.
Yeah. Cause it really is. It's a relationship and it's this odd thing of where it's both I don't even know how to, I mean that when you go into gender stuff and how to refer to your body, that's really,
I can guess. Yes. What a trip.
Yep. But, the body is both us and not us, you know, and yeah, how we treat the body is both how we treat ourselves and it's this, the body is a separate thing too. So, yeah.
Which is really interesting because I think there are schools of thought with people who might not have like quite as much, it's quite as large a wound in this area where they like haven't severed themselves. Mm. You know, like my therapist is always like, you're still outsourcing, like you're still splitting for, and because it's such an embodied practice to like feel feelings, et cetera.
Right. Yeah.
It's always like, I mean, we're working towards a place where it's like you were one, and I'm like, what's that like, you know? But I'm curious if you had any kind of revelations as such, like, or even what was the most recent one was like, where does the journey feel like for you today?
Well, I love the idea that you don't. Respecting your body and treating it with dignity and care doesn't mean you have to love like its appearance. I don't know. We're so appearance focused, you know, and just, I don't know, separating those and not being like, okay, you only deserve, you know, to be treated well if you look a certain way.
Yeah. Or you only deserve food if you weigh a certain amount. Like that's insane.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's the same thing, you know, but it's much easier to be like, I like you today. So you get, you know, cream.
Yeah. Or your whole day is shit. If you know it, the number, yeah. I don't weigh myself anymore. I haven't in years, but yeah. Mm-hmm. But I remember just being just that, you know, being such a part of the day and it would determine, you know, how it felt for the entire rest of the day.
For sure.
Which just, that's just, my whole body feels exhausted just even remembering.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, and same, I feel sad, you know, I'm just like, wow, we could have had such a good life. Yeah. At least there's still time.
Yeah. But this work is so important for, you know, exactly those reasons. People just learning that we can unlearn that stuff. It is possible. Yeah.
For sure. And what an offer, you know? So if you're struggling with this stuff, like, you know, there is a way out. There is another path, which I think is very exciting and hope-filled. And I'm curious, like, as you started to kind of heal in that, like, how did you start to divest from diet culture? Because I think for a long time, I'll speak from personal experience, like, I thought that, like, my way out of disordered eating was, like, via exercise bulimia. Mm-hmm. So it kind of went into, like, FITSPO, you know, and, like, training as hard as possible. And, like, I do love, like, I love training. I love experiencing a body as such. But, like, at the time, it was very interwoven with diet culture and aesthetics and control, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it took kind of flushing that whole thing down the toilet, throwing it out the fucking window.
Right, right.
To have a like any kind of liberation. And I'm curious, like, how did you unhook?
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but especially when it's a part of so much a part of your identity and how people relate to you and praise you for that, that's, I can make it even harder. Yeah.
For sure.
And,
especially if you have a lot of information. Like, you're like, I have like years of like insane education on the specificities of like, you know, macros and like training splits.
I mean, horrible. I got certified as a fucking personal trainer. I was
sure.
Just because I wanted the information and and it's tricky because I used to like ride century rides and climb mountains and, you know, I still think it'd be fun. I've taken, not just because of the pandemic, but I've taken a huge step back from that as part of the healing process, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of suss out like, okay, what is, you know, the eating disorder brain and what does my body actually feel good doing?
Yeah.
So starting to get back into, you know, testing those waters, but,
how exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So how did I start? I signed up for a course and then I promptly ignored it for several months. Just like, I knew some part of me just knew how, even more than quitting drinking in my case, just how life-changing it would be. And also how much scarier it was, perhaps because it was so tied up with my identity. So, I did start taking the course, and from both that and other sources, once I started learning about how diets and restriction affect our minds and bodies, about diet culture, about the harms on a both personal and societal level, I kind of couldn't get enough. And then that said, gathering information is the kind of easier part. It's putting into day-to-day practice that is hard. And
changing the patterns, which I think can be very... Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think a lot of addicts really love structure like nothing like a fucking meal plan, you know?
Like, right. Yeah. And we have to confront our own biases and fears and, you know, go against the norm. I mean, it's not for the faint of heart.
It's hardcore.
It's worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also it's interesting. I was like, there's that show, perhaps you've experienced it. It's called Physical it's on, I think, Apple TV.
You know, I heard you reference that. So I'll check it out. Is it worth checking out?
It's hard. You know, it's like, it's listed as a comedy, but it's like, it's the most accurate representation of like the negative self-talk of an eating disorder. And it's very mm-hmm. much about an active bulimic.
Oh.
But now she's in like season 3, spoiler alert. in a support group and... Mm-hmm. There was a discussion of like pleasure, like you like cis how you know food, and I think this is also kind of where dieting, sex, and like pleasure have this intersection of like, I think within diet culture, pleasure is not, it's not really a concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like,
and also the you know addict or alcoholic or alcohol use disorder brain is like. Both obsessed and immune to dopamine.
Right.
So,
right.
But they talk about like, you have no, like, she had to choose cookies for like a brand endorsement. And she was like, I have no idea what I like. And you're, of course, like one of her comrades was like, of course you don't. You have not experienced pleasure in decades.
Yeah.
Because of the control and enjoy, not even enjoy, the control aspect of that.
Right. Right. Right.
And I think that's such a novel concept of like, what if you, and I think that was maybe one of the slowest ones to percolate for me of like, what if you could like enjoy having a body for your brief moment on earth?
Yeah. Yeah. And that your body doesn't exist for the pleasure of others. You get to actually be in your body and experience it. Yeah, that yourself.
For sure. Oh my God. That's so, like, I feel euphoric and like, I want to cry when you say that. Yeah. Like, did you have a moment when you realized that and what it felt like?
What was the first, I heard it phrased a little differently, but it was about others experiencing your body versus you being the one who is experiencing, you know, and that's, it's sort of the same idea of just like, holy shit. Right. You know, and it's the opposite of all the messages of just like your value is based on your appearance. And that's all about like giving other people pleasure, not, you know, what you actually feel about going about in your own body.
For sure. Which I think is so also like gender linked, you know, yeah. And like, you know, because I do think that it's all essentially like most things in the white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. Yep. It's like for the male gaze. It's for the consumption of the male gaze.
And like, one memory I do remember of that time that I, you know, in like whatever, I was like eighth grade ish. I remember, I don't know why this feels like, I'm not ashamed to admit this, but I've never like talked about it out loud, but I remember very distinctly being attracted to my friend who, and we had some, you know, experiences together, sexual experiences, and she was a girl. And then at the same time, my older brother had a male friend over in his class, not that much older, but, and I remember just some part of me, I'd already learned just like, I wanted that person to be attracted to me, mm-hmm. not because I was attracted to them in the slightest bit, but because I recognized that that was a power that we were supposed to cultivate, you know, fucking 12 years old.
Eighth grade. Yeah. That's so powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Cause I think that it's like, you know, the dots line up, you know, and it's like, fuck, what, and what a head fuck to give to like young people. I mean, just like your body is made for the consumption of others and this will give you power in the world where you probably have none. Like, what the fuck? Yep. You know, and it's, I feel very grateful to be able to kind of deliver an alternate, there we go, message.
Yeah.
you know, that like, I remember, I think I was like listening to Beyonce in the gym, which is ironic. And I was just like, my body is not for you. Cause I was being like, I felt, you know, powerful and like grateful and, just like strong and filled with joy. And like, I was in like a subterranean gym in France and I was just like, wait, this will repulse the male gaze. Ha ha. Like, because it's for me, like it's for me. And like the delight in having a body as such was like an epiphany because it had never occurred to me that that was, you know, a possibility.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like 5 years ago, maybe less, like,
yeah. Wow.
Slow. Yeah. This work is slow.
It is nuanced too, because I do recognize like attraction is a thing and it's not all bad. You know, it's like we got to be attracted to people and, but maybe examine a little bit more why and just, you know, dive if we're willing. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And also like, how do I kind of, I think that's been one of the challenges of divesting from diet culture and kind of realizing that so much of my own attraction, we talked about this with Jesse, like so much of my own attraction was in the past about the attraction of others. Mm-hmm. Like, and so how to like, now that that's not like a priority necessarily, how do you, and to kind of navigate what your own attraction or libido even feels like,
right.
It's very confusing.
Yeah, it is.
Cause like the compass is now like just kind of spinning. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to kind of like, how did you, was the like parallel between drinking and diet culture or your own shrinking and drinking kind of like immediately evident? Or was it something that you kind of put the dots together later? Like, how did you kind of see, I read that you saw kind of like a hole in the market. Yeah. That you were like, everyone's talking about one thing or the other thing. They're not talking about the very common intersection of both.
Right. Right. So as far as like, not the quitting part, but the active drinking and dieting. Yeah. I just, I mean, it mirrored my own experience and it kept coming up with clients and I was like, is anybody talking about this? And I just, I mean, I searched for years. I only recently, like we're talking a few weeks ago, found another practitioner who actually does address both. And I've reached out to them and I hope to have more conversations. So, but that's one person in, and I'm a pretty good Google searcher, you know, just like in years. So, yeah, I really think they have a lot of parallels, and there's some parallels between the quitting process of both too. So, you're going against, you know, what people expect and maybe want from you. You're going against the grain. What else? You're no longer trying to fit in. You're no longer, I think in both cases, you're no longer working against your body. Mm. And you have to find new ways to navigate your life and your emotions.
And I think it's a lot at the same time. And I appreciate how in your conversation with Jesse, maybe we can talk a little bit about it here, like how you don't necessarily suggest that people try both processes directly simultaneously.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's it really like depends a lot.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it depends on each individual, like how, which one is doing the more damage. So which one needs more immediate attention?
Yeah. In 12 step, we often say like you stop in the order that they're going to kill you.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very apt here.
I'm remembering, I heard something somewhere that, and I don't know if this always holds true, but it was an interesting idea. And I think it kind of holds true for me, like that you can, it's easier to unroll them in the reverse order of that they came into your life. So it was, I had to unroll the drinking before I could unroll the eating disorder. So I don't know if that holds true for everybody, but it was an interesting thought.
That makes a lot of sense because I think it's like, at their very base level, both of these things, all of these things are coping mechanisms, right? So like to uproot the oldest one first, I think would be really challenging for the identity, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I think later this week or next week, I'm going to record something with Brooke Herr, who is they specialize in grief. Mm. And I think that like both of these processes, like in terms of quitting drinking and quitting, like kind of divesting from diet culture in a conscious way, can involve a lot of grief.
So much grief. Yeah.
I'm curious as to what that was like for you, if that was part of your journey.
Oh yeah. Yeah. In both cases. I mean, one of the biggest ones was just how, folks in your life may change in how they relate to you. And, you know, some of those relationships may flat out end, you know? I think even, well, I don't know, again, it's going to be different for everybody, but for me, I think even more so with the quitting drinking, just like it turns out, you know, you had folks that really were just drinking buddies and it didn't go further than that. So when that was taken out of the picture and, when we quit, you know, drinking or substances, it can kind of, be a mirror for other folks. And that's not always something that folks want to look at. So, again, talking generalities, not always, but, yeah. So losing people, and grieving, especially, I mean, my identity as, you know, the orthorexia, I mean, not identity of that, but just the identity of the, you know, fit, active, you know, person that, I mean, just random strangers comment. And now I think of like, that was so weird. And why did I actually think that was okay? Like random strangers commenting on my body, you know? But with drinking too, just, I mean, I really, really got like, I think I mentioned my main thing was wine. And I took like sommelier classes. I gave wine tastings. I mean, I was hook, line and sinker.
Like, oh yeah. You were like a lifer deep in there.
Yeah. So both of them were, you know, a big part of my identity and just, letting go of that, letting go of the relationships that were tied to it. Figuring out who the fuck I am now, you know, I mean, that's still an ongoing process. So, that can be, kind of lonely. That's why community, you know, if you can find it, is so, even just one other person is just can be really, really, really helpful.
For sure. And I think it's also, I think it can be very difficult to be like the first one in your friend group. Cause I think like most of the people I was using with, everyone's either like sober or dead.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of the jam. I mean, and so a lot of people at this point have kind of crossed over to this side, but it sounds like you might be the first one in your group of friends who are like, have decided to examine that and kind of step away from it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Cause, and I don't know if, I think you stopped when you were, younger and yes, I don't know if that may make a difference. But what's interesting is that that did happen. And also, when I started, you know, which didn't happen right away, it took me a while to actually be verbal about, like, share that I was doing this, outside of, you know, the kind of groups I was in, the recovery groups I was in, people came out of the woodwork and were like, oh my gosh, me too. You know, it's like, you're not necessarily the only one doing it, but if you may be the first one talking about it. And that's why other people feel, you know, liberated to, even if it's just you, you know, or maybe they kind of come out in that regard too. So, yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I'm glad that that's happening for you, because I think it can be like, it can feel super lonely at the beginning when you're like, I guess I'm just on this road by myself. What's that?
It was also humbling, because I fully admit I used to be somebody that was like, I don't want to hang around people who don't drink.
Oh yeah. There's a lot of humble pie. And like, even just looking at the behavior I would exhibit towards people in my life who are like, no, thank you. I would just be like, boring loser. And now I am proudly a boring loser. This is like a lifestyle. It's beautiful. Yeah. And I'm curious, because this is sober sex, what happened to your sexual or romantic, you know, relationships as you healed these areas, like both drinking and drinking?
Yeah. Can I actually mention one other thing in ways of that they're actually, I think, quitting both, or like drinking and dieting are different.
Yeah.
And this, so we already talked about it being kind of, or I did, about just the, it being messier. The quitting dieting can be, I don't know, I think it can be messier, because as you said, you have a body, you still have to eat. And during all that, we're still surrounded by diet culture. And this was actually something that came up. So shout out to the folks at, it's called the Satisfaction Factor podcast. Mm-hmm. And it came up when I was talking with them. I think it was Naomi that mentioned this. And it was such a cool insight that when you, you know, it's more common when you quit drinking that folks are going to be like, oh, congratulations, that's great. Even if secretly they may be like, you know, and I'm never going to hang out with you.
Yeah.
And when, in contrast, when you, you know, quit dieting, it's much more common that, you know, folks, unless they've been educated about like the harms of diet culture, that they'll be just confused and maybe even like, but what about your health? You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what was your kind of, I don't know, did you have different reactions for both of those, or?
I feel like because my relationship with food and body and diet culture is like, I'm not sure if it necessarily, I'm not sure if my behavior changed that much externally, because it's been so fucking slow.
Yeah.
It's more like my relationships with the behaviors changed, and I have like a better idea of kind of like, how, like where I'm at today. And like, for instance, I still really don't do like dessert or sugar, just because it brings on too much noise. But that's a choice that I make for kind of like, for wanting to stay in a loving relationship with my body, not because I'm trying to restrict, right?
Yeah, I get it. Yep.
So like the, so I didn't get that much outside information, but I did feel like I became much more sensitive. Like at this point I have a lot of recovery community and a lot of like positive reinforcement for my recovery from drug addiction. But for diet culture, I think it's increased sensitivity to other people's investment in diet culture. Right.
Yeah.
And so that becomes very difficult, because it's hard. Like if I can see it, you know, from a mile away, if someone's like talking about some weird grain, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I know. I totally know, but I'm trying not to talk about food and bodies, because it makes me insane. And it makes me like it's A, boring, and B, like, this is not towards healing. Right. So it's more like a less, I mean, more compassion, I guess, because I'm like, fuck man, this is like, I know where you're at and it's a nightmare, but also like less tolerance, because I'm just like, I can't engage with it. It's like, it sucks. And I think when somebody's in it, it's very difficult to like, be like, yeah, did you know that this is bullshit?
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, right. Like, yeah.
It's so much more kind of, I feel like the claws are so much deeper, than they were with like drug culture, because like for me, it was not cute, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But I do think it's also an interesting, like, you know, that in 12-step, at least, like, OA is for people who, it's Overeaters Anonymous, but it's also for people who have food and body dysmorphia and eating disorder. Mm-hmm. So it's very like, it's like all kind of in the same bundle there. Mm. It's not a program I've tried because I was like, no one can tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And I wasn't willing to kind of take that action. And I know for some people it really works and it's an amazing kind of path out. Mm. But also I'm like, I don't know. I have never gone to a single meeting because I was like, no, thank you.
And they're also just, I'm sure just, there are other ones out there too. So yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And so I think it's interesting that like, I appreciate how specific you are. You're not divesting necessarily. Like it's about diet culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's about kind of ceasing like that dance, which I think is such a strange, subtle, and also all encompassing like lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's such a, like now kind of looking, I can like look over my shoulder into like the hall of mirrors, you know? And it's like, mm-hmm. wow, like what a fucking trip that was when those were my priorities, you know?
Yep.
And I'm curious. So to kind of,
yeah. I'm sorry, you asked the questions.
No, it was like, I'm curious. Cause I do think that this is, I know for me at least as like my more, I mean, both behaviors, but I stopped using so young that it was like, not just a lunatic, but the like behaviors around food and diet culture were so, they dictated so much of my life
mm-hmm.
that they, of course they affected relationships
yeah.
and sex. I'm mm-hmm. curious as to kind of what happened to your sexual or romantic relationships as you healed in these areas.
Yeah. So, as I was healing in these areas, I had also just come out as queer.
Oh my God. You're like identity overhaul, motherfuckers. Guess who I am, really?
And there's so much more. So I changed careers. I moved cities. I first cared for my mom and then I grieved her dying mm-hmm. and went through the pandemic along with everyone else. So this area is still very much a work in progress.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. And I'm also grateful for the time because I've gotten to know myself a lot more and what I think I do and don't want in relationships. So I did finally dabble into the world of dating last year for the first time since my divorce. So step by step.
Can I ask what you discovered that you like and don't like, or what you feel like you're looking for?
Yeah. I mean, most of that's in my head. I haven't been able to put it into practice as much, but,
next time. This is manifestation.
Gosh. I mean, somebody that I'm not saying they have to have worked through like the same stuff, but is, I don't know, open to it and just that I get it. This is a big part of my life. You know, I mean, it's also the work I do, not just I've been through it personally and it's the work I do. So somebody who's, you know, I don't know, open-minded about that and curious, I guess.
For sure.
Somebody who's worked through a lot of their own shit and is interested in, you know, continuing to do that because I think we're kind of never done. And yeah, I mean, it's maybe it's as much of a I'll know it when I see it kind of thing.
Yeah, but I mean, those seem like very reasonable asks.
Yeah. And I've still got a lot of experimenting to do because my identity has changed so fucking much since the last time I was sort of out there, as you will, you know. Yeah.
How do you feel about it? Like, do you feel excited or do you feel like, oh my God?
Terrified, but excited. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I don't know, I'm terrified, but also, which may sound like the complete opposite, it kind of is, but also much more sure in myself. Just like, yeah, that's go in peace, but that's not going to work for me. Or like, you know, but also, yeah. Yeah.
No, but that's rad. I mean, like, I'm excited. I think it's, what a relief to cease to contort, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That's I'm excited for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm curious, like, we're going to pivot again. Guess what? More pivots. You know, again, like I mentioned, I'm a product of 12 step and I'm curious, like it's not for everyone, obviously. And what might people who don't relate to a 12 step approach find in your program or working with a recovery coach, or why didn't you take that path, or what worked about the path that you did take that you feel like that you want to bring into your relationship with clients?
Yep. As far as why I didn't, I mean, it was probably a combination of reasons. First of all, I was never trying to quit for good, and I'm probably, you know, be good to walk into an AA meeting and be like, hey, I'm just here for, you know, a month.
Yeah, like, dry January, babies.
Yeah. And I've never personally, and I want to say, like, people get to label themselves in any way, you know, be it sexual identity or this, you know, recovery, just if it works for them, if it's empowering for them. To me, the label alcoholic was not empowering. So That was another thing I didn't want to, my impression of AA was, there are probably some meetings that are a little more flexible than that, that you don't have to take it. I don't know. But, and let's see. Yeah. I wanted to find out if there were alternative ways to approach it. So I'm glad I did, because what I found really worked for me. As far as I can really only speak for, you know, I can't, different recovery coaches are going to work differently, but speaking for the way I work, it's, and how it can be beneficial, it's tailored to the individual. And so we can adjust as time goes on, you know, what works and what doesn't. And it's, you know, I kind of think of it as it's molded to you rather than you have to try and fit a mold that may or may not work for you. Mm-hmm. And you get all the attention. So that's a bonus.
True.
And just to mention it, like I have worked with some folks that also are in AA. So it's not, you know, what's the word I'm searching for? Like
mutually exclusive.
Thank you. Yes. So it can be supportive of that. You know, it's, they can be a compliment to each other.
Very cool. And I'm curious, like, what were some of the things, that you found helpful at the beginning of your own kind of parallel, like at the beginning of your own journey, especially like around divesting from diet culture?
Yeah. Let's see. So that first course I took, and then I continued to take just a bunch of others, courses, programs, whatever you want to call them, books and more books, community for sure. Cause as we mentioned, this work can get kind of lonely. And then staying in the present and not spinning, and I still, you know, have to work at this, but not spinning out about what the future is going to look like based on what the present looks like, because I mean, the future is going to change depending on what we do now. So, you know, and every time I try and guess the future, I'm wrong anyway. So yeah. And that also kind of takes, for me at least, can take some of the pressure off.
Yeah. And practice too, of just like, I want, like, as an experiment, I'm going to not obsess about things that I can't control.
Yeah.
That's rad. Continue. I was going to ask another question. Go.
Okay. And then whatever, cause I do whatever non-religious faith is. So for me, it's faith in the possibility of change, faith in working towards a world where we aren't judging each other and treating each other differently based on our appearance. Faith in a world where all bodies are considered worthy of dignity, respect, love, and care. So, yeah.
That's really beautiful.
And faith, I'm fine with the word, you know, it doesn't have to, it can have whatever connotations work for the person.
Yeah. I mean, I think like what you talk about is kind of, it is the, like the north that you choose to move towards, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be like, you know, Sky Daddy, or it doesn't have to be kind of an external source. Like,
right.
I subscribe to a higher power just because that's been working for me for a while. And it's like, I feel like that relationship is beautiful, but
yeah,
like it certainly is not for everybody. And I think that like by kind of being decisive about what you want to put your faith in, you know, and that kind of being a directional, like, decision maker is really, like, that's a really useful tool. And I hadn't really heard it put that way before.
Yeah.
And kind of on that note, like, what is your hope for this work? Like, who do you hope it reaches, or how do you hope, like, this message carries? Because I feel like the recovery that you're talking about and that you kind of offer and that you're living right now is very hopeful.
Yeah. I hope so. Sorry. So I hope to reach folks who are ready to try a different way. And I hope people hear that there's nothing wrong with you. You're not alone. And healing is possible for everyone, including you.
That's really beautiful. Oh, thank you for that. And right before we close on like a kind of effervescent note, which is called the lightning round. So don't think too hard and don't get too anxious. Like, there are no wrong answers. Okay. And you don't, it's not even that lightning, is often it's very slow. So what's your favorite snack?
if I want sweet or salty, it depends. So either popcorn with truffle salt is something I've discovered and absolutely love. And, or if it's more on the sweet side, dark chocolate covered almonds.
Very classy snacks.
I'm mixing them together. Epiphany. I've got it.
I'm like, man, it's dinner time here. So I'm like, wow, is that dinner? What is your favorite way to play?
Getting outdoors in nature. Yeah. Hiking around. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you live in the right state for it. Shit.
For sure. Yeah.
And what turns you on? And that can be like sexually, obviously, or it can be like intellectually, creatively, in terms of adventure. What turns you on?
Yeah. I think this covers a lot of those areas. Vulnerability.
Yeah. That's a good one. What is your favorite way to get into your body if you're feeling checked out or disassociated?
I have a couple, but one of my top favorites is, and there are, you know, different varieties of this, but breathing exercises, just super simple. You can do them anywhere. People don't even need to know you're doing them, you know, unless I do have one that you, it's called left nostril breathing. So it might, you do kind of plug, you know, so people would know you're doing that.
Plug one at a time. And they're like,
yeah,
my left nostril always clogs more. So I'm like,
people look at you funny, just say allergies. Yeah. Yeah.
What is this song that pumps you up?
Oh my goodness. Lately it's been Sissy That Walk by RuPaul.
Perfect. Oh yes. We have many Drag Race fans on the show. What is your favorite way to wind down?
I kind of have a process, but like I'll start going around in the evening. Well, I don't know.
You're sober if you love a process.
I don't know if you always meant in the evening, but I'll go around and like dim the lights, you know, to mirror the natural lighting as the evening goes on. And start sort of working towards like limiting my screen time and going more to books than television or something. And just being aware of just like, okay, you know, I struggle with sleep sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I'm very invested in the process of like telling my body, like gradually, like, okay.
But I don't know. I feel like it's such a sweet thing to do to oneself. Like, we're going to bed. It's time for rest. And finally, what do you love?
I love animals.
Aw. Do you have any specific ones that you're thinking of?
I mean, definitely my cat is top of the list, but they're just, I don't know. I walk around and I'm very lucky to be in a place that has lots, I'm out in nature, kind of in the woods. So they're deer and they're rabbits and there's, all these different birds and just, they're just so, I don't know, so darn innocent. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
A good thing to love. I also love animals. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on Sober Sex. You let us know where we can find you if people would like to seek your help.
Yeah. Let's see. So I have two different, online things. So you can jump from one to the other, but LaleAtkinson.com is my like overarching coaching website. And then I also have a course that you can either link to from there, or you can put in Beyond Shrinking and Drinking. And then my Instagram, the kind of professional one is at Beyond Shrinking and Drinking. Kind of a mouthful, sorry.
It's totally cool. We will link to it in the show notes. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a delight.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual